This is Health First with Dave Fuller, available across Canada through the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
So we're talking with Lucy Aframore. She's written a book called Body Respect, What Conventional Health Books Get Wrong and Leave Out. And Lucy, before the break, we were talking about some of the relationships between, our forefathers and our weight. And I'm wondering if there are ways that we can find our optimal weight and what we can do to really achieve homeostasis, I guess, or balance in our life.
Mm-hmm. I think that one of the things that can really help, given the focus on weight and the way in which so many people have struggled with food and eating because of this focus on weight, and are often made to feel ashamed of who they are, or internalize the messages that there's somehow something wrong with them. But what I'm going to suggest is that instead of thinking how can we optimize our weight, think how can we optimize our well-being. And when we optimize our well-being, that means that we're helping people to have a healthy relationship with food. So they're going to eat in a way that nourishes them and allow food to meet a range of social, cultural, psychological needs. And of course, nutrition is in there, but it's one among a number of different things that are going to influence their food decisions. So really, they're at ease with food. They feel in control around food. They're not unduly concerned if they have an extra large portion one day. They don't feel guilty if they eat food that they've previously considered banned food. And they're not dreading social occasions or anything. And also that when people begin to feel better about themselves, we can help them to reframe the idea of exercise from one that can be quite punitive and all around calorie burning and an obligation towards one where we're helping them to find ways that they enjoy moving their body. And being active is seen as something for fun, something that you do to feel better, rather than meeting external goals. And so too, bringing in other factors that we know can support people in well-being, maybe mindfulness practice is one. And of course, not forgetting the huge benefit of just social networks in our well-being. So when we can shift the focus into how can I optimize my well-being, then somebody is going to eat in a way that stabilizes their weight. And that weight is going to be their set point weight.
Okay, so Lucy, how do we do that as a society? How do we encourage the movement from the focus on weight to the focus on well-being?
Mm-hmm. So let me give you a question here, Dave. Imagine that you're a child. It could be maybe you're a 12-year-old child and you're going into school and it's Obesity Awareness Week. And so if we think that the listeners as well, that if you're a larger child, how's it going to feel going into school to Obesity Awareness Week? And of course, we know that it's well-intentioned. We know that the school's goal are to get children eating well and keeping active and looking after themselves. But of course, the outcome for the larger child is going to be very destructive. And also for the thinner children, it gives the messages that you're okay as long as you're thin. And the okay is both around health, and it also has this sort of moral valency attached to it. So let's go to a school down the road, and they've scrapped Obesity Awareness Week, and they're going to have Body Respect Week. And we can see instantly that when we shift from the weight to respect, that it opens up what becomes possible. That respect means respect for everybody, regardless of our shape or size, regardless even of our health or fitness level. So it helps people to be as healthy as they can be in the body that they've got right now. And also within that, that to keep on recognizing that our health behaviors account for perhaps no more than 25% of our health outcomes. So always looking to promote self-care and to bring in social justice. And I think when we put this focus on respect and equality, it helps people to feel more accepting of who they are. Of course, it's not an overnight thing and there'll be a lot of ambivalence. But if we change the social norms so we all wake up feeling okay about ourselves, instead of people waking up worrying about what they're going to eat and how they're going to exercise and burn off enough calories that day, we'd really see a shift.
Lucy, I think a lot of people know, when they're eating right or they're eating wrong. correct me if I'm wrong on that. You got a chapter devoted to that in the book, but are we missing something here?
In what way, Dave?
Are we missing the fact that, maybe people are craving certain foods because of stress, because of their cortisol levels?
So it has been said in the past, for example, that people will crave sugar. And when we look into this, that there's certain groups of people who crave sugar, and those are the groups of people who are trying not to eat it. Mm. So when we create any food as a forbidden food, it could be because, for any number of reasons, and also when people are choosing foods from a list of external rules and using a lot of cognitive restraint rather than a sort of more connected way of eating, where they're choosing foods relying on body signals, relying on taste and fullness and social occasion, when people eat intuitively, then they're drawn to select foods that they feel better for. We can think that, and the fear, of course, when I first start working with people, that if they feel that they can eat something that's been on the banned list, if they feel they can eat chocolate cake, that they'll eat nothing but it. So people often fear they're going to eat with abandonment. But it's the dieter who eats with abandonment. It's the dieter who needs to finish the chocolate cake because they're never going to eat it tomorrow. And the person who is moving towards intuitive eating, perhaps they do eat all the chocolate cake, but if they're tuning in without judgment, they realise that they didn't actually feel so good for the whole chocolate cake, and perhaps the next meal that they're going to have is going to be something that's less energy dense, that's got less sugar in. Not because it's necessarily the idea of it's good for them, but simply because they're going to feel better for it.
Maybe we should ban salads and then perhaps more people will eat them.
And then we'll start craving them. Now that's novel.
I want to talk about emotional empowerment, because you're talking about a lot of issues around well-being and self-care and social justice that really relate to, that you're saying relate to weight gain, weight loss. How do we get people to a point of emotional empowerment where the weight falls off?
Well, what I would say is that again, there's a lot of assumptions in the idea that fatter people are fat because of emotional eating. So people of any shape or size can learn to regulate their emotions through food. Mm. And it could be that there will be a group of people who have gone above their set point because of emotional eating. And within that group, when people learn to eat more intuitively, their weight may or may not change. And that's why it's so important to take the focus off weight. Because if people are given the impression that if you sort out your eating, to all intents and purposes, you're going to be thin, then we're not being accurate with the facts. And so the point of intervention will be somebody's relationship with food. And also, of course, it can be self-acceptance. And we know that people can be thin and still struggle to accept themselves. So if a fatter person struggles with self-acceptance, it's not the weight itself that needs to change. It's helping people of any shape and size deal with their conflicted and perhaps changing feelings around their size.
Thanks for that, Lucy. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about calcium and what you should know about calcium.